How sad, how lovely, how short, how sweet to see that sunset at the end of the street and the lights going on in the shops and the bars and the lovers looking for the first little stars. Like life, like your smile, like the fall of a leaf. How sad, how lovely, how
I can see her very well as being one of those quiet, far-left, radical. I could easily see her as a very strong socialist, communist. I don't think so. I don't know. Not in any formal way. But I don't think she was afraid of those things. You know, Connie really was a person without borders. I guess that's why I can see that she would be more radical than I gave her credit for at the time. Remember, I was really young. But she was a sort of a universal person. It's one of the impressions that I would say right away. She was a person without borders.
This is Spinning on Air. We heard a song by Connie Converse recorded in the 1950s and the speaking voice of Riley Trumbull, who knew Connie in the 60s. I'm David Garland with part two of Connie Converse, Let Me Be If I Can.
Looking up chords for guitar in the back of the People's Songbook, I find I had figured most of them out by myself without thinking about their names, but it would be a good idea for me to know their names, too. I used to think a guitar was a vulgar and unpleasing instrument. But if treated properly, it rises above the realm of the musical cliché. And with a good song, even clichés sound good.
Previously, I covered the story of Connie's music. She was an imaginative and original songwriter who didn't receive the recognition she deserved and who disappeared in 1974. This Spinning on Air episode continues a more complete portrait of Connie, who was also a very thoughtful political activist and writer. The year is 1951. Connie lives in New York City and is working as a freelance writer, having left her writing job at the Institute for Pacific Relations, an organization that had been targeted in witch hunts by anti-communist committees in the United States Congress and which was raided by the FBI, which seized classified government documents. This is also when Connie Converse is working on the songs we've come to know. Trouble, Honeybee, Talkin' Like You, There Is a Vine, and Sorrow Is My Name are all from 1951, according to Connie's notes.
To me, tomorrow will be all the same. For sorrow, sorrow, sorrow is my name. Oh, keep on seeing.
Like anyone else engaged in political work at that time, Connie, no doubt, was following and was concerned about the anti-communist investigations going on in Congress, including Joseph McCarthy in the Senate and junior Congressman Richard Nixon, who was launching his political career by persistently pursuing the alleged communist spy Alger Hiss. In 1952, Connie began a one-year writing assignment for the Institute for International Education, writing on the topic, the Japanese Leaders Program of the Department of the Army. Earlier, this organization's president was Lawrence Duggan, a former colleague of Alger Hiss at the State Department. Duggan was named in House Un-American Activities Committee hearings in 1948 as a possible KGB recruit, and was then questioned by the FBI. And on December 15, 1948, Duggan fell or leapt to his death from his office on the 16th floor of the Institute's building in Midtown Manhattan. This was a dangerous time to be targeted by the government's anti-communist panic. Connie had worked for two institutes accused of espionage.
Far apart.
After 1952 came a lengthy period in Connie's life, 8 years, from January of 1953 to January 61, a period that any artist or activist could recognize and understand. She got a day job. She stepped away from politics, from international policy and her published writing, and she became production assistant and typographer at Academy Photo Offset, 17 East 22nd Street in New York City. She was way overqualified for that job. We can imagine the brain space that was freed up by her work as a skilled proofreader, covering all the typography produced by our intertype photosetters, according to the letter of recommendation she left New York with in 1961. I have to wonder what songs were in her head as she, quote, learned and became competent at operating the photosetter correction device, unquote. The arrangement must have worked for a while. That was probably the period during which she focused most on her music. It was when she met Gene Deitch and his friend Bill Bernal, who did home recordings of her music. It was when she was on Walter Cronkite's TV show, her one and only public performance that we know about. It was when a well-established singer like Susan Reed was taking an interest in Connie's music and singing it in her concerts.
Stars run home, it's almost day. I got a man saying, honey, I wanna stay.
I got a gal saying, honey, I'm here.
By 1961, the convenience of her boring job was probably wearing thin for Connie while she tried or waited without any breakthrough for her music to be recognized and for it to catch on. Her brother Philip was by then a professor of political science and sociology at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Connie loved her brother and his wife and their two sons, and if she went to Ann Arbor, she'd have a chance to complete her unfinished college degree at the university. She decided to get out of New York and join them there. Among Connie's papers, which she left well organized in a file cabinet in Philip Converse's home, are some undated pages describing a cross-country trip from the Delaware Water Gap to Oregon to Hollywood through the South and back up north to New York. Here are a few vignettes.
Arrived in Pecos before breakfast. Left after breakfast for San Antonio. Flattest country yet, sand and mesquite. Then the Mesa country. Sergeant Jepson of the Air Force, the biggest joker in the deck, and Petty Officer Busby of the Navy kept me happy as far as Houston. A laugh every half mile, and then somehow got into a long discussion about segregation, but wound up on good terms. Eastern Texas, much greener, more settled. Oil, cotton, corn, oleanders, on to Lake Charles. Feet looking like balloons after two nights in a bus seat. Oil wells flaming in the night. Woke up in Louisiana after fitful slumber. A lusher sort of New England in some places. Cotton fields, shacks. The doors for colored and doors for white. And a palpable feeling of cowardice and shame as I went through the white one. Every sizable house has a pretense of pillars. New Orleans at noon, hot, dazed, and weary. A man walking down Carondelet Street in a white suit with a gleaming sword in his hand.
Amber Benson reading the words of Connie Converse. As soon as she was in Michigan, Connie, known there by her original name Elizabeth Converse, joined the Ann Arbor Women for Peace. A little later, she initiated and helped run a city seminar on unintended racism. During her first year in Ann Arbor, she was a freelance editor, and in 1963, she connected with the Center for Research on Conflict Resolution at the University of Michigan, and with their publication, The Journal of Conflict Resolution. She was center secretary in 1963, managing editor of the journal from 64 to 69, and co-editor from 1969 to 71. The journal had been founded by Kenneth Boulding, a well-known economist, peace activist, poet, systems scientist, and interdisciplinary philosopher. Boulding wrote more than three dozen books, including The Image, Knowledge in Life and Society, and Conflict and Defense, a General Theory. He was married to peace activist and writer Elise Boulding. Also working at the journal at that time were William or Bill Barth, Gay Crouch, and Caroline Riley Trumbull, known then as Caroline Cohen. All told, Connie was at the Journal of Conflict Resolution for 8 years, the same duration as her time at Academy Photo Offset. But it must have been a very different experience, both far more rewarding and far more difficult. Riley Trumbull.
You know, University of Michigan at the time I knew her in the 60s was a remarkable place in lots of areas.
How so?
Well, it was a political activist center. That was that kind of activity. But it wasn't just politics. There was a lot of pushing. Well, there was a lot of music that was far out. There was a lot of, I don't know if you've heard of the Once Group.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I was in the Once Group. Oh. That's where I came from. I was a dancer. I wasn't a musician.
Yeah, it's the Once Ensemble or the Once Festivals and the Once Group. Mm-hmm. It was a really important interdisciplinary sort of avant-garde series of concerts and festivals, a really dynamic scene that was focused in Ann Arbor, Michigan. It was started by composers Robert Ashley and mm-hmm. Gordon Mumma and others, and it drew all sorts of interesting people from the avant-garde to Ann Arbor. John Cage, Morton Feldman, Lamont Young, Pauline Oliveros, many others.
Uh-huh.
It was a really fertile time and place.
Those musicians, they were rebellious. They were pushing to the edges. They were thumbing their noses at the music department, which was stuffy. And so there was rebellion in the arts and rebellion in music and rebellion in politics. And there was a lot of activity about it and rebellion in how you dressed and, you know, the 60s.
And did you see Elizabeth Converse as part of that, or was she a little bit on the side, at least in terms of the cultural life and her appearance or anything like that?
No, she was definitely on the side. I saw her as a political activist working with Ken Boulding, busy with the journal and, you know, running administrative person. She was, I didn't realize that somewhere in her past she was and would once again become a musician.
Hmm.
She was a dowdy dresser. I mean, you know, people were wearing mini skirts and funny clothes and long hair, and she had braids wrapped around her head. She had a shirtwaist dress, usually kind of a pale blue, pale green, pale color, flat shoes. I can swear she never wore tights in her life, much less, you know, fancy ones. She was just like a straight-laced, like a wallflower. There it is. She looked and performed like a wallflower who saw everything and knew everything. Good-natured. I mean, you know, just not fooled by trends, let's say. Not mm-hmm. participating in the trendy stuff. I don't know if she ever went to a Once concert. I don't remember seeing her at any of those.
Here's an excerpt of a recording by the Once group. This is a piece by Robert Ashley. Riley Trumbull participated in this one. It's called The Wolfman. As you can hear, they were sort of taking things about as far as they could go, further than most music had gone back in the early 60s. But it's poignant to me that Riley says Connie didn't attend any of those concerts. Connie liked to experiment herself. Here's an excerpt from a piece that she wrote in French, Deux Escargots.
On est ici, ça vous plaît, l'autocar pour Paris. Il partira ce soir, vous verrez du pays. Mais ne prenez pas le deuil, c'est moi qui vous le dis. Ça noircit le blanc de l'œil, et puis ça on le dit. Les histoires de cercueils, c'est triste et pas joli. Vous prenez vos couleurs, les couleurs de la vie. Alors toutes les baies de les arbres et les...
Connie Converse, experimenting with the possibilities of music, but not like the members of the Once group, trying to tear down all convention. So while there was this vital experimental music scene going on in Ann Arbor when Connie Converse was there, she stayed on the sidelines. We know that Connie had friends, that they enjoyed and admired her and cared about her. But, as she indicated in several songs, she felt a gap, a distance, made by the world and of her own making. As she wrote,
"Human society fascinates me and awes me and fills me with grief and joy. I just can't find my place to plug into it."
Did you ever, in the social situations, have any sense of her having a partner of any kind, or was she close to someone?
No. No, not at all. Not male, not female. Mm-hmm. I mean, she was good friends with Gay. Gay was always... Gay. They were such a funny friendship because... Elizabeth was, as I said, picture her colorless and a little dowdy, you know, and Gay was very flashy with like short red skirts and fancy stockings and, you know, lots of makeup. They were an odd couple of friends, but this is what I mean by without borders. Connie looked past all of that. You know, she and Gay were friends on the friendship level, and the packaging didn't sway Elizabeth at all. Elizabeth didn't put on makeup to match it or mind, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I honestly, what would the word be? I can't think of her in any context of romance. The only male person she seemed absolutely dedicated to Ken Bolding, like dedicated to him. She believed in him totally. But she was great friends with Bill Barth. Bill was a funny person. He was from the Ozarks. He had run away from the Ozarks when he was 5 years old, brought himself up, went to university. I don't know how he ran into Elizabeth and Ken, but he and Elizabeth drank together a lot. They were warm friends, but there was no, I never had a sense of her in a sexual side of her, a romantic side of her. No vibes, mm-hmm. I think that Elizabeth had hopes and dreams that were maybe repressed, or she just kept them very much to herself. I forgot this. Of course, she and Bill were great friends because of the music. He played a gut bucket. You know what that is. A gut bucket is a wash tub upside down with a broom handle and a piece of cat gut strung up. So you strummed it like a big bass.
Uh-huh. Okay.
It's an Ozark instrument. Mm-hmm. And he used to play that and some other, the comb and some other of those sort of homey American things. And they did music together. She would sing. She played the guitar. He did the gut bucket. But Bill and Elizabeth did a lot of that together.
Ever since we met, the world's been upside down. And if you don't stop troubling me, you'll drive me out of town. And if you go away, yes, trouble ought to do. Where will I find another soul to tell my trouble to? My bed is made of stone, a star has burnt my eye. I'm going down to the willow tree, teach her how to cry. But if you go away, as trouble ought to do, where will I find another soul to tell my trouble to?
The Journal of Conflict Resolution's subtitle was a quarterly for research related to war and peace. From early in her association, Connie had the idea to write a review study of everything the journal had published from 1957 up to that point. "Nobody asked me to do it. I wanted to do it," she wrote in a letter. It was a chance to interpret the journal's past and shape its future. It was a project that fascinated and at times overwhelmed her, and which she completed and published in the journal's December 1968 issue. She called her article "The War of All Against All." 1968 was a year of global turmoil, and here was Connie, trying to understand and illuminate the dynamics of war and peace, the science of conflict resolution, and the sociology of war. From the article,
what follows is the record of an encounter between an educated layman, one who hoped large-scale warfare might become obsolete, and a very large mass of scholarly writing addressed to that hope. I had to look for a rough-and-ready way of combining diverse conceptual frameworks originating in psychology, social psychology, sociology, economics, and political science, not to mention newer frameworks such as those of game theory, operational research, and the like. What I did, in effect, was to cut a conflict paradigm in half and come up with a control paradigm. In the famous film High Noon, for example, one cuts the dusty street in half between the sheriff and the outlaw and finds that the two pieces resemble each other in certain basic analytical respects. Each centers on an actor involved in a situation which he is trying to control and which notably includes another human being. The action involves a control plan, a control attempt, and an outcome. I suppose this is really why I have come to formulate a set of four questions which relate the control paradigm to the study of human conflict. Three of them can be scientifically investigated. Given a specific episode or situation in conflict, one could ask about the specific persons involved in it. One, who is controlling whose behavior/experience in what regard, to what degree, by what means, to what ends? 2. How do the involved persons themselves answer this question? 3. who has the right or the duty to control whose behavior slash experience in what regard, to what degree, by what means, to what ends. 4. How do the involved persons themselves answer this question?
That's just a sampling from early in the monograph, which continues for 61 two-column pages of thoughtful, scholarly consideration and insight. Other than her music and possibly the novel that she one day hoped to write, it was Connie's masterpiece. She brought her full intellect to it, and, along with her other accumulated stresses, it wore her out. You mentioned that you were involved with SDS, the Students for a Democratic Society, and Connie helped you set up an office for that?
Oh,
is that
yeah.
the case?
That is the case. This was in 68. Tom Hayden, Rennie Davis, the whole group of people in that main organization, they were in Ann Arbor preparing for the Democratic Convention in Chicago. And they needed space, and I was working at the center at the time, and I talked to Elizabeth about it, and I said, they need some room, they have no money, what can we do? And she talked to Ken, and Ken said they could use the a kind of a spare room off the offices of the journal, and in addition, use the typewriters and equipment and copying and all of that. So it was like a godsend.
Huh.
And they moved in. We did so much. I mean, propaganda came out of there like crazy. Huh. I was not a big person in any of that. I was one of those little soldiers who ran errands and did everything. I'd secured the space for them, and they were very grateful for that. And then one day they left. And you know what they did? They took the Selectric typewriters. They liberated
the
IBM Selectric typewriters, leaving me here embarrassed and Elizabeth embarrassed. And, you know, if they had just asked Ken, if they had said to Ken Boulding, can we take those 2, 3, 4 Selectric typewriters, and what about the copy machine? He would have said yes. They stole them. Those rotters. It was very shocking to me. I was such an idealist, and it just like really rocked me that people I really liked and believed in and trusted could do such a thoughtless, careless, really high-handed thing.
In a letter to Clinton Fink, her co-editor at the Journal, dated March 31, 1971, Connie wrote,
"To use the technical Latin, my ailment seems to be half a nervous breakdown following a year or more of the inaudible screaming memes. Way back in 1964, as you know, I started my review study of Journal of Conflict Resolution. Nobody asked me to do it. I wanted to do it. So, for more than a year, my self-imposed task of the JCR review became a monstrous combination of fascination and frustration. I remember driving home from the post office, mailing editorial matter, after dark, month after month, and noticing the current phase of the moon and telling myself that, God damn it, by the next full moon, I would be a certain mile further onward in my manuscript and a certain mile closer to the end of that particular kind of frustration. We all know how madmen are governed by the moon. I remember telling Bill Porter in January or February 1969 that I was suffering from postpartum depression with regard to my monograph. That was really the first scream of the memes mentioned above. But of course, I screamed too quietly to the wrong person. Feeling still quite sane, I settled down to the business of trying to catch up with a backlog of editorial work. But the memes had already got their claws into me. After that, it was all downhill. No uphill, of course, from my own viewpoint. Downhill in terms of my professional performance and my basic job. Toward the end of 1970, I began to realize that I might have to believe the unbelievable, that the basic nerve and will by which I had always been able to survive my difficulties might have worn out or broken and might not be easily reparable.
Let's talk a little bit about her drinking. She drank all the time, so she was definitely an alcoholic. And I think that you could see the physical wearing of that just, you know, in the time I knew her. My guess is she used drinking to hold it together, all this anger and rage, which she could very well have had. She'd certainly had a right to it. But it wouldn't show. Her exterior wouldn't crack.
You say Connie drank all the time, so you mean in the middle of the day?
Yeah. Well, let me add this. You know, there was a lot of drinking in the middle of the day all over the university and all over Ann Arbor. People had those martini lunches, those 5-6 martini lunches. They were real. They were not a story. Bottle of wine, certainly. She drank a lot of scotch, Johnny Walker Black. I think she had a bottle in the drawer of her desk. If you saw that today in an office, you would be rather shocked and she wouldn't be allowed. But in those days, it really wasn't that uncommon.
Sad lady, walking through town with a light, sad step and a golden gown.
Connie felt acutely that she had let her colleagues down, because the tedium, detail, and secretarial work of being an editor had become intolerable for her. In the same letter, she writes,
"One of the earliest responses I had to my 1968 JCR review was from a woman scholar in Denmark who was doing a small-scale study of the role of women in the maintenance of academic journals. She had a strong impression that the dog work or shit work of maintenance tended to devolve on women after the predominantly male creators of a given journal had withdrawn their intellectual penises and let nature take its course. No, she didn't put it quite that way. I am putting it more sharply than I would ordinarily do because of the women who will come after me."
In the papers that she left behind, Elizabeth complains about and is justifiably angry about women's role in academic journals as being the ones who sort of get the work done with none of the glory or satisfaction. Did you see that? Did you see her dissatisfaction?
Oh, yes. Well, she wouldn't be raving and ranting about it. That really wasn't her style. She would be talking in a very, you know, low-key kind of subdued way. She wouldn't be making a fuss, but she felt very strongly. I mean, it is a true fact that Elizabeth and Gay ran the journal and much of the center, did the heavy lifting for everyone, from the tiniest things like putting stamps on huge mailings, because in those days you had to put stamps on them.
Right.
and things that went out that she edited, heavily edited, or even wrote would go out under Ken's name. Mm-hmm. I know that bothered her. I mean, I know it was kind of an inside joke that, and Ken gave her credit in the family, you know, acknowledged her generously, but never publicly. I mean, you can imagine they didn't have, we had computers at that time, you know, big cards and card readers and boxes of computer cards. But for the most part, her notes were handwritten or, you know, typed up after being handwritten. And there were a bazillion index cards and they were all filed. And it was a massive logistical problem that she and Gay were on top of at all times. It was never a feeling of chaos in the office, just competence, her competence. And the women did do the work, and the women among themselves said, "We do all the work." Yeah, but that was so typical. I had that happen to me in the history of art department. It really ticked me off too.
Uh-huh.
My work that I did by myself with the help of another student, a huge, huge project that I and my professor were then invited to the Museum of Modern Art to do a demo of. He took all the credit, all the credit, and all the papers. My name didn't appear anywhere. Anyway.
Connie drafted a letter of resignation from the journal, but in a few days or weeks, an unexpected response came. In April 1971, a group of her friends, in an early kind of crowdfunding, pooled their resources to give Connie a cash award, quote, in recognition of her unique contributions to scholarship, education, and human individuality, unquote. There were also notes insisting that she not tear up their check. On May 2nd, 1971, Connie wrote to these friends.
Once I had examined all the pieces of paper and blown my nose repeatedly and been patted kindly on the back several times, I knew I didn't have the faintest intention of tearing up the check. I thought to myself, this is not an investment in my future. Who knows who has a future? It is an investment in my present.
Connie, who hadn't taken a non-working vacation since 1964, used her award to go to England. In 1974, she wrote,
in the months after I got back from my desperate flight to England, I began to realize that my new personal incapabilities were still stubbornly hanging in. I did fight, but they hung in. Maybe my time in England, financed largely by my friends, was too benign a treatment. At any rate, it's the only sustained period in my life that I now look back on in the silliest detail as fun, unproductive fun, not getting anything done. I did sit in my bedsitter very often in bemused despair, but I also had fun. Since then, I've watched the elegant, energetic people of Ann Arbor, those I know and those I don't know, going about their daily business on the streets and in the buildings, and I felt a certain detached admiration for their energy and elegance. If I ever was a member of this species, perhaps it was a social accident that has now been canceled.
That's one of the letters she wrote just before she disappeared. Even her brother Philip Converse, with whom she was close, didn't know she was going, and he never knew where she went. But he learned from his son Peter how Connie's old nemesis Richard Nixon delayed her departure in August 1974. Philip Converse with his wife Jean.
She planned this carefully for a long time. It was very clear. And she was living in town, but she had a lot of stuff at our house. We go up to Glen Lake here in Michigan typically every summer. And we were about to do our August trip. And we specifically invited Connie to come up there with us, and she never had.
But we really were concerned that she was depressed.
Yeah, yeah. I think you're probably right. We were worried about her at that point.
Yeah.
But at any rate, she said she didn't want to do that. And it turned out that Peter was at that time in high school, I guess.
Yeah.
And he had something going on, and so he decided to stay home. Connie was probably horrified to know that Peter was going to be at the house. She had the run of our house, of course, and she wanted to take that time to move her stuff out of the house and leave. And she told Peter she was going to leave on a vacation trip. I mean, that was her cover story to Peter. And he told us that she didn't leave for about 2 or 3 days later than she had told him she was going to leave. And the reason was that she couldn't get away from our television set and the Nixon impeachment and resignation. Yeah. And, you know, she hated Nixon like you can imagine. Yeah. So I just found that an amusing offshoot of it. She left 3 days late because she had to see it.
She had to find out how it was going to go.
Philip Converse considered hiring a detective to locate his sister, but decided he should respect her desire to disconnect. And Riley Trumbull has an interesting story to tell.
I read that she disappeared in 1974, and that was sort of a shock to me, because I kind of think that the last time I spoke to her, I think might have been later than that.
Really?
Like 1975 or 6.
Uh-huh. What was that conversation about? Do you remember?
I remember it almost verbatim.
Uh-huh.
Because I've told the story a couple of times over the course of the years. But I'd have to give you some background. You know, she did a really horrible thing to me at one point, and not because she was a mean and horrible person, but because she was trying to be a very good person. So I'm going to tell you this story, especially because it takes us to that last conversation I had, which has to be 75 or 76. But at some point in the course of that hotbed of social times, because while all the stuff was going on, the glue that held all of Ann Arbor together were these parties that people had. People had parties at home. People had parties on rooftops, people had parties in parking lots. There were parties all the time, and Elizabeth was always at these parties, and the Boldings often had these parties at their house, nice house. She was friends with Bill Barth. At some point in time, Bill Barth and I got together, and he wanted to marry me, and I was uncertain about that. I had been married to Milton Cohen, who was an art professor from University of Michigan. We were separated. But anyway, she came to me one day at one of those parties, and she made this plea that I take Bill Barth's proposal seriously because he was such a wonderful person and so on and so on. Well, I certainly can't say that that did or didn't influence me. It didn't turn me away from the prospect, but it certainly didn't influence me. But anyway, I married him.
Oh.
But when I married him, I found out that this really fun person with very good taste and all kinds of like good times actually was not such a good guy after all. And it was just a nightmare. It became a horrible, horrible nightmare. And I divorced him within 2 or 3 months.
Oh. Uh-huh.
That seems like it would be the end of a story, wouldn't it? But two things happened. This is why I'm sure it was after 1974. Anyway, there was a lull, and I went on with my life, and I met someone else, and I was dating someone else. And suddenly Bill Barth appears and starts making all kinds of threatening noises. And at one point, he actually came to my workplace, the other person in the same workplace. This sounds so ridiculous, this story I'm telling you, but cross my heart, it's true. I was working at the Michigan State University Art Library, and this other person was a bibliographer at the library. And one noon, he and I went out to lunch. We came back to find the place in complete chaos and lockdown and police all over. It turns out that Bill Barth had arrived at the library brandishing some guns, looking for the person I was seeing who was stealing me away from him or something like this. I mean, it was so crazy, dramatic, stupid. Anyway, they carted him away, and that was that. But the news, of course, went all over. And that's when I got this phone call from Elizabeth. Out of the blue, early one evening, my phone rang, and it was Elizabeth, and she said, "Caroline, this is Elizabeth Converse." In a slow voice, I could tell she was drinking. I could hear ice cubes. She said, "I'm calling to apologize. I really, really feel terrible about this." She said, I knew when I told you that Bill Barth was a really good person. I knew that he wasn't. But I just thought you would be good for him. And I didn't think about you. I only thought about him. And I am so sorry. And then she said, I'm just calling to tell you this. She said, I have nothing to lose. I'm down on my uppers, she said. And I just am sitting here feeling like I did a terrible thing. And we had a little more conversation and she signed off.
What was that phrase? She's down on her uppers?
I'm down. I'm sitting here. I'm down on my uppers. You know what that means?
I've never heard that before. Was it familiar to you?
You must be too young. Of course. I'm from the South. And the Depression and the after effects of the Depression lasted a lot longer in the South. Down on your uppers means you've walked the soles of your shoes off. You're so poor. You've filled in the holes with cardboard. You've got nothing left but the uppers. That's how poor you are.
Uh-huh. Wow.
Down on your uppers. So she was saying she really had nothing to lose. She had nothing. I didn't think to ask where she was. I just assumed she was still in Ann Arbor. I didn't know.
We don't know where Connie Converse went, how long she lived, or if she's alive now. But her music is becoming more widely known, appreciated, celebrated, and loved.
Sad lady, walking through town with a light, sad step and a golden gown. Dancing on down with a wreath of roses and violets and rue and daisies for a crown. See how the lake is frozen over. See how the grass is turning brown. Stars came tumbling down. Sad lady, walking through town with a light, sad step and a golden gown. Mad lady, dancing on down with a wreath of roses and violets and rue and daisies for a crown.
This is Spinning on Air. I'm David Garland. I make the podcast. Anne Garland made helpful editorial suggestions. Thanks so much to Riley Trumbull for sharing her thoughts and memories in our interview, and to Amber Benson for reading the words of Connie Converse. We heard short excerpts from Martha Wainwright's performance of One by One, Sam Amidon performing Trouble, and in a moment, Laurie Anderson singing Sad Lady, all of these from the recent Zadig CD, Vanity of Vanities, featuring the songs of Connie Converse. I wrote the liner notes to that album, and that's what led me to discover some of these other dimensions to her life that I've been sharing with you in the podcast. Connie's own recordings came from the archive provided to me by Gene Deitch and from Dan Zula and David Herman of Squirrel Thing Records, who also provided the Philip Converse interview recording. I made the instrumental guitar versions of some of Connie's songs used here in the podcast. Go to spinningonair.org for more information and for more episodes about Connie and others. This is an independent production, and your support can really make a difference. You can contribute through PayPal or Patreon. More information about supporting Spinning on Air is also at spinningonair.org. If you like the podcast, tell your friends or share it on social media. Please rate it and write a review on iTunes. Spinning on Air is a registered trademark of WNYC Radio, used by permission. Thanks for listening.
Sad lady, walking through town with a light sad step and a golden gown. Mad lady, dancing on down with a wreath of roses and violets and rue and daisies.